monitor, listening to the Baroque brass playing Date with Her. Success doesn't usually come to hobos, but in just a few minutes, you will meet a former king of the open road who became a self-made millionaire. I'm Brad Crandall, and here come the new Christy Minstrels. A hobo and a dishwasher. Doesn't exactly sound like a smashing success story, does it? But from that background, Ralph Corcell emerged to become the head of a multi-million dollar business empire, a self-made millionaire, and a man with some sound advice for today's younger generation. Talking with him, Monitor reporter Candy Jones.
We know you were a poor boy, Ralph, but were you ever hungry poor?
No, we were never really hungry because dominant in Italian-American families of the period, they always had lots of spaghetti on the table. Poor, yes, clothing scarce, no toys. But food, there was always plenty of food on the table. Mom would get out there and scout around the Italian neighborhood and buy from push carts, and she'd always feel vegetables and get bawled out by the peddlers. But she'd come home with quite a bit of food for the family, and it was always fair.
What one quality, other than luck, would you say was responsible for your success?
I'd say a great ambition to do things. As a young man, I traveled extensively, on the bum, of course, on freight trains most of the time.
That's when you were a hobo.
But yes, when I was a hobo, right. But it did teach me quite a bit. It taught me about life in general. I started reading after I traveled because I felt I knew so little about life. And even though I barely got through grammar school, I was able to acquire some sort of an education later in life that helped me. But as I traveled about the United States, I met a lot of very, very wonderful people that suggested books that I should read.
Would you say that today a boy, a high school dropout of 15 or 16, would have a similar chance of becoming a millionaire as you have?
I think there is lots of opportunity in the United States for everyone in all walks of life. And I can cite a little anecdote. Some years ago, while traveling as a traveling salesman, I was driving through the South, and I had my radio tuned on a panel show, and I think it was Otto Preminger was being interviewed, and he was asked how he became what he was today and what happened when he came to America. And he said he had come here 40 years before with equivalent of about $1.25 in his pocket, and he landed in Philadelphia. An uncle of his met him on the dock and said, you should go back. You came here 20 years too late. There aren't any more opportunities. And he says, there's always opportunities. And, of course, he's a perfect example. But I think the kids of today, we became what we were or were what we were because of poverty. And I think that they're just bored today. And this is the trouble with the kids that go down to the village.
Do you think they have too much?
They have, yes. Now, we have to understand that their parents were youngsters during the Depression. They probably, in many cases, had nothing. Lots of them became affluent, like myself, and when their kids came along, they said, well, we're going to give our kids everything that we didn't have. But actually, they've spoiled them.
We've been speaking with a very happy, contented millionaire. That's author Ralph Corcell, whose career span has gone from hobo to dishwasher, and author of the bestseller, Up There, the Stars. This is Candy Jones for Monitor.
This is a new one from Marilyn May titled simply Feeling.
Feeling good, feeling fine, feeling groovy all the time. Ain't it great just to be feeling? Feeling lost, feeling low. Feeling helps to let you know you're alive. Be glad you're feeling. Once you pack it away, brother, you can't buy one more day. Brother, there's no time, so let your feelings roll across your mind. Feeling loved, feeling warm, feel it all before you're gone. Take a breath, touch a leaf, start feeling. Feeling loose, feeling cool, even feeling like a fool, up or down, just so you are feeling. Oh, feeling rain, feeling sun, feeling love for everyone, feel so good.
Brother, just know the great.
What should we all be thankful for this Thanksgiving? Monitor asked Mayor John Lindsay of New York that question, and here's his answer.
This has been a year of extraordinary strain for all Americans, but as we approach this special holiday season, we can look beyond the strife and turmoil at home and abroad and see that there is much for which we can give thanks. Men of goodwill around the world are working together to restore peace and order, whether it's at the conference table in Paris, in the war-torn Middle East, or here in our own city of New York, which has just gone through a period of great emotional stress. We can be thankful, too, that our nation is still strong, that our institutions of government have survived intact, a great test to which they have been put this year, and that the transition of government, which we are about to undergo, will be a model of democratic orderliness for all the world to admire. On behalf of the 8 million people of New York City, I want to wish a joyous Thanksgiving to all of our fellow citizens across America.
The Thanksgiving thoughts and greetings of New York's Mayor John Lindsay. At home or while traveling, you're always in touch on the Monitor Beacon.
There's a destitute child overseas waiting for your help. Only $16 a month will bring him a cash grant, better meals, clothing, medical care when called for, and education. You get a history and photograph of your foster child and exchange monthly letters with translations. You watch him grow. Let some child love you. This is Charlie Brown urging you to write Foster Parents Plan, Box 944, New York, 10008. Charlie Brown is alive and well and living on WNBC Radio 66, New York. How about you? If you dig the alive sound, join me, Charlie Brown, right here weekdays from 3 until 7 p.m. We'll keep you going with music, keep you posted on traffic, and get you home. Alive and well.
WNBC, Radio 66, New York.
Brad Crandall back with you as Monitor continues at 19 minutes after the hour. This week, a firm in California advertised a Christmas gift idea for that difficult business executive on your list. It's a miniature blanket called the Executive Security Blanket. It has, according to the ad, a satin binding you love to feel. Isn't that swell? But you know, it just seems to me that a corporate president clutching a security blanket and sucking his thumb just may not be a real big hit at the next board of directors meeting, unless they're the directors of the security blanket company. Larry Page's orchestra and their version of the song made famous by Mary Hopkin. Those were the days. Next, the most talked about woman on Wall Street, Wilma Sauce, and her pocketbook edition of the news.
Thank you. 1968 will go down in history as the year of surprises. The grand surprise came from Le Grand Charles, who made the whole world wait and pocketbooks tremble, and who, despite the weakness of the franc, chose to decide the destiny of three world currencies. Even the most dedicated to Gaulle watches could not visualize him playing King Canute, ordering the Financial Times to turn back from devaluation of the franc after what appeared to be virtual agreement on a modest devaluation to keep the virus from spreading. And especially after a $2 billion loan from the nine richest nations in the free world to bail France out. Only Louis Gilbert, stockholder who has French forebears, warned me about de Gaulle, who had assured the French people that devaluation of the franc was an absurdity. He said that no strings attached to the loan was regarded as largely a face-saving device, since devaluation of a currency was declared to be the decision of a sovereign state. But de Gaulle was the sovereign. After all, despite de Gaulle's troubles since the student uprising, despite inflation in France, despite reserves of French gold and foreign currency, the lowest since 1962, and despite the flight of more than $1 billion worth of francs since November 14th, transferred by businessmen as well as speculators, France may still have the third largest gold supply. To bow to West Germany, whose hard currency has made it the dominant country with whom even the United States has to reckon now, was more than de Gaulle could stomach. Despite pressure from the United States and Britain, West Germany refused to devalue her currency. Why be amputated, the West Germans asked, to cure someone else who is sick? Instead, it made other concessions, reducing the tax advantages given her exports. Instead of devaluation, de Gaulle has chosen a diet of austerity, invoking wage, price, credit, and exchange controls. It's interesting to note that in answer to a question this week about devaluation at the Woman Investors Clinic at the Waldorf, Leif Olson, economist of the First National City Bank, the largest U.S. bank in international trade, said, "The worst things to fear were not a rise in the price of gold or devaluation of a currency, but an austere economy program and competitive protectionism in world trade." And you can add to that the black markets that come from controls. Meanwhile, Mr. Fowler, our lame duck treasurer of the United States, was jubilant that de Gaulle had refused to devalue the franc. President Johnson cabled de Gaulle promising cooperation in France's objectives. They feared a switch in speculators' attention more than the Hong Kong flu. These steps brought this comment from monetary experts and gold watchers, the lame leading the blind. "Devaluation," said de Gaulle, who ought to know, "solves nothing. France has had 18 devaluations since the 20s, the last one being in 1958. What is devaluation? A nation's money is made cheaper in relation to other countries' currencies. If the franc were devalued again, it would mean an American buying francs or paying for goods in francs would get more francs or more goods for the dollar. If the mark was revalued and upvalued, it would mean the reverse. You would get fewer marks in exchange for a dollar, and German goods would cost Americans more. Devaluation makes a country's exports cheaper and its imports more costly to buy. For example, revaluation of the mark would have made it more expensive to buy one of West Germany's biggest exports, the Volkswagen, one-third of which are sold in Germany, one-third in the United States, and one-third to the rest of the world. Devaluation is sometimes called instant inflation because prices at home are soon raised to compensate for the loss of value of the currency in international trade. France has already been suffering from too much inflation since wages were raised, wiping out the workers' gains and causing unrest. But devaluation enables a government to pay off its debts in cheaper currency at the expense of its creditors, or, to use a less polite term, to cheat its creditors and its bondholders. But aged Le Grand Charles, like President Johnson, has an eye on history. Last week, The U.S. stock markets, bolstered by the flight of foreign capital into the relative haven of U.S. equities, shrugged off the war between the ailing franc and the Deutsche Mark, the healthiest of free world currencies. It was more concerned with softness in car sales after the auto boom. It remains to be seen whether, now that the economy is beginning to show some real signs of slowing down, whether the stock market will cool off despite hopes for peace, infusions of European money, and inflationary expectations. But uncertainties still hang over the stock market. Governments have danced to the tune of speculators. That dance is not likely to change until a restructuring of the world monetary system, during which the price of gold may be raised, and probably will. Unless something is done in the early days of the new administration, Nixon, unlike Roosevelt, will not be able to blame his predecessor. It only took 3 weeks for the speculators to unsettle the franc and almost caused the mark to be revalued. Unless speculators unsettle the dollar before January 20th, Wall Street is saying that when it comes to taking steps to raise the price of gold or letting the dollar float free in foreign exchange, Nixon's the one. I'll be back next week with the highlights of the Woman Investors Clinic, as I promised you, pocketbook news permitting. This is Wilma Soss, spelled S-O-S-S. My pre-recorded views, as usual, are my own, and not necessarily those of the National Broadcasting Company nor the Federation of Women Shareholders in American Business.
Wilma Soss and the pocketbook edition of the news will be heard again next week at this time. You're with Monitor in and around Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. You're hearing us on WKBO. Monitor continues shortly with the award-winning NBC News program, The World and Washington, an in-depth look at the United States' role in world affairs. This is Brad Crandall.
My name is Roscoe. The show is now. It happens weekdays on NBC Radio.